Hey, how's it going, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Movie Mentors, the Quarantine Edition. I'm your host, Jeremy Boros, and today I am really, really excited to be speaking to one of my favorite directors, the incomparable, the fierce, the passionate, the intuitive, Alfonso Gómez-Rejón. Getting his start as an assistant to legendary filmmakers like Martin Scorsese and Nora Ephron, Alfonso now sits in the director's chair, helming the most innovative and memorable films and TV series of the last 10 years. Whether it's iconic shows like Glee and American Horror Story, the indie darling Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, the historical drama The Current War, or the genre-bending thriller Hunters, Alfonso's imagination and range of experiences make him one of the most exciting filmmakers working today. So please, sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with today's mentor, Alfonso Gómez-Rejón.
I'm doing fine, and I'm back. I'm at my mom's house in Laredo, and sitting on the same couch where I watched movies day and night. I don't know how. And Letterman, I don't even know how I made it through school. But I don't have a lot of memories of actually doing homework because I was just here on this couch watching movies and stuff, VHS.
So you're basically tapes. Greg from Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl?
I regressed. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask, knowing that you're home in Texas. I want to throw the hardest question at you first. What is your mom's favorite project that you've worked on?
Oh, I think Me and Earl, 100%. Yeah. I think that because it was so personal and because we experienced Sundance together, you know, she's sitting right next to me, and that was the first time we had screened the movie with the dedication to my dad. So it was incredibly emotional. And I was surrounded by all my high school friends, or even kindergarten friends. I mean, a lot of people I grew up with made it out there. So I think that one will always be something that'll be hard to replicate in any kind of way. It just was special. Yeah.
It's, would you say it's probably the most personal thing you've done so far?
I think so because a lot of it was conscious and a lot of it was not. You know, I think it certainly reveals itself to you, and you realize how much you were working through. And sometimes time reveals it to you. But yeah, there was a lot that was kind of driving me to make the movie, which was to give kind of grief a certain shape so I could work through it, because I hadn't. I think I was in constant denial and then just so busy. So that was certainly, and then look, Current War was personal in a different way. And the things I do, the film I would do next, I hope to do next, one of two of them are very personal. So I'm hoping to always find my way into something that I come out a different person by the end, or clearer in some way. Otherwise, it'll feel like a job. And hopefully I never have to do that.
Do you sit down when you take on a project with questions in your mind of what you're really trying to get out of this? Do you have a sort of checklist before you sign on to something of why you're going to do it versus not? Or is it more intuitive?
It's a combination of both. It's a lot of intuition. It's a lot of reading something. Okay, I can't shake it. I'm thinking about it. I see certain sequences. You can't shake it, and you wonder why that is. And a lot of it is intuitive, and you can't really try to make it too intellectual and like try to really process. But there is the moment when you, okay, why me? Why now? That I think is important, even in a very simple way. Like, what is this about, really? And it could just be one word, you know, is it a part of me in this character, and it's the worst part of me, or something like that. So there's a lot of that. That's a lot of fun, I think, that makes you want to get up and go to war every day, because it's not always easy. So that's, if it's a simple, why me, why now, that always helps. You have to really feel it. And then hopefully along the way, if your approach is, and I love the technique. I like the craft of filmmaking, and a lot of colleagues and mentors and stuff in my life also have been primarily writers who were there to protect their words. And that's equally as valid a reasons to want to direct. But sometimes if you approach it a different way, then it's fun to start imagining certain motifs or visual ideas, and then realizing them is also a fun part of the process. You know, it just depends.
Before we get too far down, I want to go back. I was looking up where you're from, which is Laredo, Texas. And for those who don't know, that's right smack on the border of Mexico. And it looks to me like it's a pretty quiet town, a lot of shipping, a lot of like warehouses and trade and stuff happening. So I'm really curious about how that place informed you in your desire to become a storyteller.
I was lucky to have parents that really encouraged the arts and exposed us to the arts, whether it was theater, either down in Mexico or in San Antonio, which was the biggest city near us that had a theater and had a lot of touring companies would go there, where you see Yul Brynner and The King and I, or cool. Peter Pan or Mickey Rooney and Sugar Babies, whatever. They leave a big impression on you. The movie theater was 1.5, you know, so we had the fourplex at the mall, and then we had a beautiful Art Deco theater. It's a gem of a building that's completely, abandoned now. So an old film would kind of, one of them would go to the downtown theater just to die. You know, you'd see it there and be magenta and scratches, and by the time it got there. But I think we were around art a lot, music constantly. My dad's side of the family, and my mom as well, there are composers, and so there were always people here singing, or family playing guitar or piano, or reciting poetry. There's a lot of arts. My mom has basically a radio in every room, so she could like twirl from room to room and dance. I mean, they were always dancing. There was a lot of that. But I think what made the biggest impression on me was that my mom would often, she had a Super 8 projector, and she would project it for us in my bedroom. She would clear this one desk, and it'd just be a white concrete wall, and we'd gather and she'd project cartoons for us, or a lot of family films, which I found the most fascinating, because they would go back to her father and his Super 8 camera, then my mom and her Super 8 camera, and I was just transfixed. And of course the film would burn, and she'd have to splice, and she'd teach me how to splice, and
oh wow, so you got it early.
Spool it again and project it again. And that was that I think was the beginning of this kind of fascination with that. And I think being an introvert for most of my life, I think I was always a pretty good artist, like fine artist, like drawing and sculpting and painting. We were always exposed, basically. So, and then film, I was embarrassing. I'm embarrassed to say I was afraid to sleep in the dark. I was afraid of the dark, afraid to sleep. So I'd stay up watching TV constantly until everybody else went to bed. And then I would sneak into their room to sleep and then run back when I heard my mom's alarm go off, so that they would think but I had slept in my bed the entire time.
And the same thing.
I was comforted by movies. And then my sister had come back from a class trip when I was in sixth grade. She was in eighth grade. And she just like offhandedly just kind of said, you know, there's a career in that. Like film directing is a career. And as soon as she said that, I started to see things differently.
So at what point did you put a camera in your hand and start making your own things?
Much later. No, later. In high school, I wanted a camera. My parents wouldn't buy me a camera because it was a phase. And plus, the handy cams were very, very expensive back then. But I had a friend, Gina, who had one. So every either English class or French class, whatever I had, my way would get around doing it, like whatever.
Assignments.
Assignments. You'd make a film. Just to make little. Yeah. And I did those, and I enjoyed the process a lot. And then, when I decided to apply to NYU, I applied off of still photography. I borrowed another friend's camera and took some photographs and developed them and got in using those. And I didn't really start making films until I landed in New York.
You've said, and it is definitely known, that Martin Scorsese, to use your words, changed your DNA. I just want to know a little more detail, like why was Scorsese for this young boy in Laredo, Texas, so impactful?
I think it was Mean Streets that really spoke to me, because he was almost speaking to me directly. And because it was so much about brothers, and I found so much of my brother and Johnny Boy and me and Charlie, and he almost was able to say things that I was feeling. It didn't have the words for, it just transcended, you know, words in some way. And it really got me. And then I started to watch everything of his that I could find at the VHS store. And then luckily, by the end of my maybe junior in high school or something like that, Faber and Faber came out with Scorsese on Scorsese. And then that became my Bible. and I just would read as, you know, there was pre-internet. I'd read that and tried to see as many of those films as I could, but you couldn't find Paul Pressburger films here or anything like that. To get a sense of his journey and his path, and which led me to New York. And again, other things happened at the same time, like Do the Right Thing came out. I saw it in the movie theater alone. And that also blew me away. And the fact that he had gone to New York, NYU also just made it clear. And I think Oliver Stone as well. It just felt like that his path was one that I should at least try to copy in some way, because I didn't know what, anything else.
Other than obviously getting an education, did you have other key priorities when you first got to New York? From the small town, now you're in this big city.
To meet him. I was very, very determined to work for him. I was very determined. And I had my first like counseling session where you meet with a guidance counselor at NYU. First weeks there, if not the first days there. And I said, they said, what do you want to say? And I said, I was very driven, very shy, but very driven at the same time. And I said, I wanted to meet with Scorsese. And he says, look around, everybody else is here for the same reason. And he was right. I mean, you know, but I didn't know. And so it was a huge letdown. But at that point, I was already working as a PA and a storyboard artist. I'd already started really working in production from my first morning in New York.
Really?
I got my first job. Uh-huh. And little by little, I just started to get a bigger resume and got me into different doors of different people and producers and assistants until eventually, by my junior year, I was interning for him.
Do you remember the moment you first met your hero?
100%, yes.
What was it like?
Well, when I first got to his office, he was promoting Age of Innocence, so he was not around, and I was hired by the second assistant, Lise Kerrig, is her name, and I showed up in a suit for the interview to be an intern, right? And then I got the gig. I was referred and recommended by other people, so I'd go there, and you know, I had to do different things, whatever, different jobs, Xeroxing, things like that. And then he was coming back from his press tour, but they hadn't told him there was a new person in the office. And it's like a family there, you know, and they weren't ready to tell him yet. So as soon as I'd hear the door, I knew exactly where I was, and I hear the door, I was ushered into the Xerox room to hide. So because it was too soon to introduce new elements into his life. That was a direct quote. For the first couple weeks, I could only hear him, and then they would usher me out, or they send me to his mom's house.
This is, you know, insane.
Kathy Scorsese, who's, you know, was a, you know, is a lot of his movies, you know, Catherine Scorsese. And I would go there and I'd run errands for her, get groceries, hang pictures on her wall. We'd watch tapes of herself on Regis. And then I'd get a call on her landline. I didn't have a cell phone. It was really kind of pre all that, really. And okay, it's good to come back. And then I was invited to a screening of Age of Innocence for grad students on like a Sunday. And I was invited and I sat with his crew. And then later his assistant said, you were noticed, or like he gave you like, he's like, you're good. So then he would come into the office and I was free to roam the office. And he would just look at me and like nod like that. Like he knew who I was, but there's, you know, don't like make small talk. You just, you know, be respectful. And I remember that nod was like a phone call to my parents. And then little by little, he starts getting comfortable with you, part of that, of his family. And then before you know it, you're watching films with him in the screening room. And we saw all the beauty and everything. Sometimes there would just be movies, and sometimes there were movies that had left more of a mark, but he was open to everything, and his generosity was insane. And then eventually, you know, I was brought out to Vegas to work for him on set.
Of Casino, no dream. Less.
Yeah. Yeah, it's dream. A total, absolute dream.
Well, it's literally the merging of your dreams and your reality, which not everybody gets to experience very often. I just love the progression of first you hear his voice, you're hiding,
yeah.
Then you get a nod, then you get a word, conversation, and obviously now he's a good friend and mentor to you. And it's just,
he saved yeah, and I don't know how much he did, because he had, if there was a fight, if there was ultimately, if Harvey and I couldn't see eye to eye on a final cut, Marty would have the final cut. That was part of my deal. And when that blew up, Marty did get his final cut, and then he was able to give it to me and then finish the film. But that thing about hiding and all that, I'm sure he was not aware that this was happening. He just,
right.
Sometimes things are happening around him that he had no idea. They just assumed that he would not feel comfortable having a new person there until they broke the news. but he might have been fine, you know, who knows. But yeah, and I remember the very first day of production. I have so many good stories, so many good memories. I remember the very first day of production, because it was like an 18-hour day. I remember like sitting right behind his director's chair, just literally on the floor, being right as close as possible should he need something, but never in the way. I was invisible, but I just couldn't believe there he is. There's his director, there he is, there's a monitor, there's De Niro, there's, you know, it's like, how is this happening? And it was a huge production. And, you know, it's exactly the kind of film you wanted to be a part of. You know, it's just, you know, it's all about excess, but you were in the middle of it too, and being there for the private moments and realize how the struggle is always, it never changes. It's always scary. It's always difficult. It's you're just trying to get to the truth of something and trying to make your day, all that kind of stuff. It's always a part, it's just a part of the process. And it felt like I could think I could do this, you know. About a year after, I was asked to be his assistant at the office, right after Casino, actually. And I said, I just, that wasn't me. Like, I knew what that job entailed and I wanted to keep telling stories. So that's when I decided to head out west and experience what grad school would be like. And I applied to AFI.
And that can be a very risky choice. I know a lot of people face that choice and they're never quite sure when they should leave a great assisting gig like that. How were you balancing being of service to Scorsese, Nora Ephron, and Iñárritu and De Niro and all these people? Were you also going home at night and writing screenplays? Or how did you make sure you weren't going too far off your own path?
Look, and maybe I did for a while. I'm not sure. They're all different, all those examples. Scorsese, it was just soaking it all in. Film history, how little you knew, that humility that he has. And then the talent, you can never copy that. You just observe it and have the privilege of witnessing it firsthand. You can't really copy that. But his humanity and Thelma's humanity and generosity and the lessons they taught me and the high bar they set, right? That's one thing. Nora was after AFI, and I was her assistant, but she did push me to direct Second Unit for her, uncredited. It was the sequence that I did. It was a still shoot that was a part of the secondary kind of storyline that didn't make the final cut of the film, but that she had that confidence in me, and I was able to pull it off. And then by the next film after that, she forced the studio to make me, to get me into the Guild, to direct Second Unit. So that was, she kind of pushed me. So it was, it wasn't always an assistant. She always saw me differently. You know, I later found out, I mean, I could tell that it wasn't enough for me to be her assistant. She then pushed me to start showing my work by either doing shot lists for her for insert ideas that she would just say, do this, and then be impressed by it and then hand me something else. So that really is her generosity. For Alejandro, you know, in Iñárritu, I was in LA, there was no work there, and I came home to Laredo and opened a coffee house with a friend of mine. It was pre-Starbucks here, and I love architecture. It was again a project, an art project. I designed the space, built it out, and then I was told that by a friend of a friend that Iñárritu was looking for an assistant that spoke Spanish and for 21 grams. And so I ended up taking a few weeks off and went to Memphis and then to work for him, and we got along great. And that was more of research for character work. So I did a lot of research for Benicio's character. So it was an assistant with a focus on research. And then we got along. And by the second film on Babel, he asked me if I wanted to work with him again. I said, yeah, but I'm doing Second Unit now. And she goes, okay, so you'll do Second Unit with me. And that's how I got that. So, but there is a point, and then one thing led to another, and then Ryan Murphy on Eat, Pray, Love led to Glee, which was really my first directed by credit, but that was already in my 30s, you know? So at some point you're like, well, I ever able to make my own film? Or it wasn't enough for me, basically. I always was aware that whatever I was doing wasn't enough. I still had other, and I still, obviously, you still want to die with a body of work that maybe means something, but I wasn't happy being, and some people are happy getting to a certain level, but I had other dreams. So I think that was constant, which was also could be very, you know, difficult because, you know, it's such a hard industry and you get close and not close enough. You get a script that's about to sell, signs you with an agency, which happened right after AFI. And then the agent, you know, summons you to CAA at the time, this is in the 90s, and then says, I don't know what to do with you. And then you walk out not having one anymore. But little by little, that was the process.
Obviously, I feel like there's a direct parallel between directing Second Unit and being a guest director on a TV show. I mean, you're essentially stepping into someone else's creative vision and you're trying to fill that role appropriately. But like Ryan Murphy gave you the big break of Glee in a lot of ways, directing your first episode of TV. So how exactly do you negotiate having your sense of authorship on an episode? Or, I mean, I guess it's easier on an episode than it would be doing Second Unit, but
yeah,
with everyone else's opinions. And
yeah, when you're doing Second Unit, you are stepping into someone's vision in the process, hopefully learning about how would you do things differently if this was your movie, but giving them what they need, but also it sometimes giving options of what might be better on the day that would also contribute, because if you know, you understand the style of the director. So you're serving the film and that style, but you maybe see something new that they weren't there to see and you offer that up. So that is that. On the TV thing is I've never had to really copy a style or never allowed myself to feel that. Like I didn't want to just step into Glee and just do coverage. You know, wides, mediums, close-up wides, and finish early and be adored by the line producer. That never was. I saw it as an opportunity to express myself. I love musicals, okay? I turned it down originally, but I was convinced to do it because I thought TV at that point, I was such a film snob, and it changed my life. But I storyboarded everything in that episode, 17 laryngitis first season, right? At every scene, every musical sequence, because I got links to the tracks that were going to be used. And I would time all the camera moves by the second and really prep them carefully, the very first one, and try to do as much as I could in the future ones. But sometimes your window of prep was smaller and smaller and smaller that you had to kind of trust your instincts sometimes. But that, and I went up to Ryan Murphy for the first meeting and I showed him the book. It was like literally a book of all the drawings for every shot of the entire episode. And he just flipped through it and gave it back to me and said, just do whatever you want, shake up the style. If anyone tells you they don't want to do it, tell them that I wanted it. That's exactly what it is. So that episode actually does look a little different than, there's certain things that you're not going to, you know, art direction, costumes, that is what it is. Of course there's a palette that's been established way before you got there that is not going to change. You didn't cast it, but what can I do with the camera that you know, I'm not going to make some kind of Italian neorealist situation out of this thing, you know, but how can I contribute? And I did. And it was really a test because it's so public and film can be so private. As big as it is, you really, with the actors, your first DP, and there you had the entire crew. My first day was half a day. The second half of the day where another director finished her episode and then I came in. So the crew just like, lunch break, and all of a sudden a new guy comes in and I want the camera to be here. And then the DP says, no, we're going to put it over here. And I'm like, fuck, I have to win this, you know? No, it's here. And this is why, and this is the drawing, and this is what I want to do. And then you do it. It takes a little longer, but then you start winning these little battles and eventually you get control of at least that episode. And it worked. And that led to more and more stuff. But I never liked feeling, and Ryan, the thing about Ryan, he never made me feel that way. And he really made me a part of, certainly in American Horror Story, made me feel like I contributed to the style of that, even from the very first pilot, which I did a kind of a significant second unit on, again, storyboarded and visual research for him as we discussed what the pilot would look like. And then I directed a few sequences and designed certain sequences for him. And he said, if it gets picked up, you can do the second one. And it did. Yeah, picked up and I did the second one. And everything, all the TV I've done after that, I've never wanted to feel that way. And I'm sure it comes down to my ego, but I never wanted to be that person. And the best, now that I'm in a position to sometimes hire directors, I'm always disappointed in the ones that to just do coverage quick and everybody loves on the day. Then you sit back and watch the episode and it well, as other people, when they have a point of view, they really take it to the next level. You really feel the hand of a director, and then the actors really feel the hand of a director, and they like to be observed and directed, not just having a voice in Video Village somewhere.
So with Glee, watching it all consecutively, all the episodes you directed, you can see this more, I guess, freedom and confidence and experimentation as you developed your craft throughout that process of covering the musical sequences, because so many of them are shot in the Glee room. It's like, how much can you do in the same room over and over again?
Yes. I would read those scripts. I'm like, oh my God, how do I? But it was, that was the challenge. I am going to do it differently. I am going to find a point of view, you know?
Did you keep that time code, very tight, regimented storyboard approach? Or did you eventually get to a point with the musical sequences where you were just more free-flowing?
I had the luxury of time for that first one. I never really had that luxury again. Your window started to get smaller and smaller to prep, but I always did prep, whether it was just me staying up all night and drawing it out, doodling on the page for everything until you see something that is going to be a motif for this episode. I'm going to try to do an episode where for instance, that was Adventureland American Horror Story, that I'm never going to move the camera. I'm not going to move the camera this entire sequence for this. I'm just going to, I use it as experimentation. So I always try to experiment there with lenses. I mean, American Horror was all experimentation for me. I would do coverage with 6mm lenses and fail. And sometimes you see that, I'm like, God, but you just want to push, how far can I push this? And sometimes it works, but I ended up learning about lenses and using them and pushing them all the time. So I always did do a version of that, but sometimes never the luxury of time coding it to the second, but at least it was to the minute. I mean, there was a something that was a certain flow to it, a certain design to it, that was always a conversation to be had at the beginning. Like, this is what I'm going to try to do with this episode, et cetera.
Looking back after 12 episodes of American Horror Story, by the way, Emmy nominated for Coven. We shouldn't forget that, which is fantastic. Do you look at a particular scene or a particular episode and think, I cannot believe I got away with this in terms of pushing boundaries?
I think it was the coverage with 6mm in an episode of Coven. I forget to which one it was, but it was Kathy Bates was wheeling in something on a little cart from the kitchen into the, I forget what it was, but I was trying to do something that within the 6mm had become 10mm and it's a visual effect that I thought I could pull off, and it didn't work. So it just didn't work, but it was always fun to fail because of, especially with Coven, it was so kind of arch and campy and funny, and because it's horror, and that allows you to be very expressionistic with the camera. It didn't destroy the episode. It was just kind of, okay, that was it didn't quite work, but I could recover. But it was fun. I did learn and grow so much as a filmmaker because I was, and I loved the work.
What a lucky playground you had. I mean, to be so early in your career, mm-hmm. to be on a project for that long that allowed you so much freedom. If you had very, very little prep time, as you often do in TV, what are the sort of non-negotiables for you that you've got to feel confident with before you can step on set?
That's a great question. I learned to trust. I guess I was more of a formalist in that I'd like to draw and then either through NYU on, draw and then realize my drawing. And that was a rush. Like, I imagine this, draw, and then how close can I get to that? And there's a discipline to that I love. But what I learned to trust about, and that was something going into it that I had to, that was who I was. But because of the speed of TV, and sometimes you get pages the night before, the day of, or your 1 week prep turns into two and you get a script, is to trust your instinct and let that guide kind of the flow of the episode. So then it becomes a combination of sketches, doodles, and instinct, or sometimes the rush of walking into a set, not knowing what you're going to do, and then making the decision and playing with actors and understanding, you know, the situation. But I think, I don't know if I can answer your question, is like, I guess non-negotiable is, at least for me, it's like, if you're going to go in it for the very first time, is to have a point of view, why you're going to tell the story a certain way, even if you're stepping into a show that's already in progress. I think the worst thing to do is again, just do master's overs without a point of view, because then it's just, what is that? You're just covering everything and then figuring it out later. It would be more interesting and take the exact same amount of time, or even less sometimes, if you only know the 3-4 shots you need, and then be able to explore the performance, because actors don't want to feel like puppets either. Like hitting mark, shoot, and move on. You want to be, they want to feel they're being seen and that you're sensitive to what they're trying to say, you know, what the scene is about and what they're trying to convey, and never forgetting them just because it's television and it started before you, that the actors could direct themselves, I think is a mistake.
Have you ever struggled in trying to elicit something from an actor? You've worked with some of the greatest living actors, Jessica Lange, Al Pacino, Benedict Cumberbatch, Kathy Bates, all these people. They probably have less of an issue. But in terms of working with up-and-coming actors, have you ever struggled, and how do you help them find a performance?
Yeah, it's a good question.
You've worked with a lot of young actors.
But sometimes, look, I adore actors, but they all have, like all directors, they all have their own process and a way into scenes, and some like to rehearse, some not, some like to discuss it, some don't. Some are great in the first take and don't really see the other ones get better as you go along, and you have to find a way for them all to feel comfortable and safe, to experiment, to play. They might want to take it a certain direction that you didn't see, but if you don't lose track of what you wanted, they may get there eventually. It's just being sensitive to who they are as human beings and how they like to work, and then planning the day. If you have to shoot someone's close-up first before this person, because you know that person needs to warm up a little more than this person, I think it's just talking about it and not just shooting right away, but taking the time so it doesn't feel like a machine. We're talking about television, so, and obviously eventually film too, which is, that's a different process, but is that you're dealing with actors who are emoting, and regardless of how ridiculous sometimes the setup is, especially in horror, you watch like Jessica or Sarah Paulson, they're in that moment, and there it's pure and it's honest and it feels real, even if it's in this kind of umbrella of horror or witches or whatever it is, murder houses and aliens, whatever it is. That's what makes it so good, is that they're getting to the truth of a moment. And I think it's just in getting to know them and talking to them instead of rushing and make them feel rushed. I rather go over and figure it out and how to make up the time later so that you get the best out of an actor, because that's all that really matters. Even if it was not a fancy camera move, but just a close-up, it means nothing if they didn't get the time to define the truth of that moment. And that's also a moment that I love, that process. I love looking at actors. I love being right by the camera, because it does make it intimate and does make it just a very human way of interacting with another artist, you know? And that's the stuff that I really love. No matter, sometimes you look behind you and you see, you know, hundreds of people, monitors and people on their phones and extras, whatever that is, but it's really just, that's the secret, you know? So it's just sometimes, yeah, you have very young actors sometimes on Coven, for instance, who don't have really much, a lot of training, but they have something that's a mystery to them and you, and it's just making them feel comfortable so they're not intimidated by an elder statesman in the room, you know, who has a whole, so it's just managing that so everyone feels safe and could fuck up and then get to a moment. And then also communicating how you see the scene and why the camera's there and what's it going to do. And this is why, so they feel secure. That to me is a joy. I miss that. I miss horror story. It was insane, but every day you show up and you're like in this madness with like the greatest actors.
Have you ever thought about directing theater? I feel like you would.
Yes, all the time. I love theater. I see when I go to New York, I lived in New York obviously for a while, but I spent a lot of time there over the years. Projects that happened, it didn't happen. Recently Hunters, but I'll see a few plays a week, two a day on weekends if I can. I did it in current war. I mean, most of the cast are out of theater. I would just, sometimes I'd wrap early, go see a play, maybe not off, like, but I love the experience. I love the thrill of it. I'm terrified of it, but I really want to do it.
Well, Al Pacino is obviously such a theater beast. I'm sure he would love to talk about collaborating with you. You've mentioned in other interviews, and he's one of my all-time favorites, that he's very humble. Is he one of those people that it's just like every single take is something new and the direction becomes more about kind of reigning in what he's doing?
Pacino is amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of conversations early on, months before, really getting to subtext. What is this really about? Really understanding every word And then with him, I usually, a lot of hunters actually was what single, certainly in the pilot, one camera, minimal coverage really, and longer takes that could take an actor as often as possible from beginning to end, like a theatrical, you know, as much as possible, instead of starting, stopping, take them to ride the wave of an emotion, hopefully. And with Al, it was great because you never know. Sometimes you have actors that are going to challenge you until they get to know you or break you, whatever. But he was so open of like, you know, you come prepared, obviously, you know the scene inside out. You've talked about it way before in advance. Like, what is the scene about? This is how I see it. Then you walk him through the staging of it and how you see it and why. And the repetition, his repetition was fascinating to see him go through the entire scene. Some very long takes, like towards the end of the Hunter's pilot when they go into the Batcave and they go to the armory and he's washing his hands and all that kind of stuff. Very long, long takes with a lot of marks that had to be hit loosely, you know, but general here and stopping here and doing this or that. And then the repetition. Then he goes away, you light, he comes back. Usually an actor's ready to go, okay, we already did it. And he's not ready, he just kind of looks at you, and just again and again and again. And then he forgets it. And then he kind of gives you a look, and it's like not every take. You don't need that many at that point. He just forgot it. So it's second nature. He's living it. He doesn't think about the marks, this. He's just lived it already, and it just becomes very lived in and naturalistic. And it was beautiful to see. One, two, three takes, and you're done. And sometimes you say, I'll give you a free one, and he'll do it. And they all are slightly different, but they're all real.
That's a theater training. I love it. That's a theater training of just repeating it until you forget it, getting it in your bones so it feels real. Anyway, we've talked a lot about your television work, and I want to talk about your first feature. You know, that's a big deal for a lot of up-and-coming filmmakers. It's a rite of passage. So can you share a little bit about that experience with us?
Well, it's The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Not a lot of people talk about it. No one saw it. There was a lot of really beautiful ideas in that, of a town defined by a movie and the fictionalizing of real pain, you know, and thought that was something really interesting. And I was really nervous about making it because I had something else in mind, what I wanted to make as my first movie, that ended up being this pilot called Citizen. That was going to be my first film. And I remember Ryan Murphy took me out to dinner once and said, you want your first film to be Citizen Kane, but maybe it's okay if it's Boxcar Bertha. And it really kind of hit me because maybe it would never happen had I kept holding on to something. And I found my way in, and then I was very nervous because things weren't working out during prep the way I wanted them to go, and a lot of cuts because of budget, and I was losing my way of the reason why I wanted to make it. And I remember I had a call with Scorsese. I talked to Thelma, and Thelma said, Marty should give you some advice on this one. And I waited for a call from him one night. I remember bourbon with a big rock of ice, and I was staring at it with the phone next to it as the ice would crack. It was like kind of like in Taxi Driver with the Alka-Seltzer, right? And then he called, and we talked for a while, and that's always going to be private because it's kind of sacred, those conversations. But ultimately, the decision was make it because it'll teach you how to make the next one, if you can still find enough of your voice in it. And I was really proud of the film, and then and a beautiful time making it. And the studio had seen it, but was very unhappy because it was too much of an art film. And I remember I went to the first test screening and the studio head wouldn't even look at me. I was like, good boy. Then it scored so well that by the end, he had me in like holding me and like, this can be the next Halloween. And then forced us to reshoot the ending to keep it open-ended so they could do sequels for it, because they really thought they had something. And I fought against it because it made no sense, and gave in because, you know, someone else is going to shoot it for you. Did my best, and it started scoring lower and lower and lower. And I was trying to get him, let me release the first one. We knew that one scored better, but all these ideas and money have gone into the new version of it. Eventually, it started to get a compromise, but I could still stand behind it. And remember, it was one of those things where I never want to be this powerless again, right? And of course, the current war happened, and there you are again, and then you win. Right? Because you keep fighting. And that one, is, in some ways, I lost. They forced like a last line of ADR that I was really against. And they sent in a representative from the studio and the sound mix to make sure I did it. And at the end, when the studio exec walked away, she said something like, oh, it doesn't matter, they're going to dump it anyway. And I was crushed. Literally 30 seconds later, my phone rang. Literally 30 seconds later. phone rings, it's Jeremy Dawson, my producer for Me and Earl, because that movie had fallen apart. Called me and said, we're back on. And I went to Pittsburgh the next day, I think, or 2 days later. And there I was prepping Me and Earl. Just like that, like your life can change.
That's crazy, you know, but that's just classic showbiz kid, you know. But yes, let's transition and talk about one of my absolute favorite films of yours, which is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. I've seen it several times. I adore the film. Two scenes really stick out for me in terms of camera movement. So you've got that incredible phone call with Greg when he first calls Rachel, and you're tracking him all throughout the house. You're basically giving us some exposition. We're seeing the house, we're going upstairs, downstairs, meeting the other characters. And then you have the scene much later when Rachel decides that she's not going to continue with treatment. And it's one low angle shot that doesn't move basically the entire scene. It's just locked. How do you determine when the camera needs to move and when it shouldn't?
Well, that's the biggest mystery, right? You know, that's what Scorsese's such a master, because he just knows every time. You know, I think not to be too kind of new agey about it, but you have to trust your body. Your body, your reason you're doing this is because you have, you're intuitive to an extent, you know, to, you know, you, that, you know, your body is telling you when you feel like you need to move the camera, because it's a certain story that is okay with having what some might call visual style, or what do you call it? Like, I don't know. It's sometimes language, a character. Yeah, sometimes the camera could be a character, and the movement is, it can feel like it isn't distracting because it feels like it's a part of, it's appropriate. And sometimes it's best not to do anything. And the first case with the Steadicam shot of Greg on the phone, that was an accident. That was actually three scenes. That was a scene with his mom. That was the other end of the conversation with Rachel. And then it was post-call, I think. Or it was a three, I forget, but it was three beats. And in designing it, you realize, oh, we could do this. So, you know, Chung-Un Chung was a really great, like a brother to me. And well, maybe we don't need to see the other. Then we thought, well, I think the other, I remember what the shot was going to be with Rachel, which is the back of her head. You never saw her face until you saw her, until you really met her. But they realized that if we kept the shot going, you get a sense of how childlike this boy was until the end, when he's crawling on the floor like a literal baby, right? And then by doing Taxi Driver, which is always going to be, which is Taxi Driver with the commentary, which is exactly what I saw when I was in the hallways of NYU. Like, all those references are things that moved me. Then it just would just continue to evolve. And then it just evolved. And okay, it's one shot. That's what it is. Now let's try to get it. And then we did that forever till we finally got it. Cause we, you know, it's what classic thing. We're about to get it, and all of a sudden the camera hits the wall, and you have to do it again. So that evolved because it felt that was the right way to do it, even though it was in Zion. And the other one was the same way. It was always going to be simple. It probably was going to have two pieces of coverage, you know. But then in designing that master, we realized, well, that's a composition that I think could hold. And then I remember it was just three of us, Jonas Bacquartelli, my first AD, Chung, and myself in the corner, right by the camera, and the two actors, that's it. And I'm almost like about to cry just talking about it, but it was, I think, four takes. And the second you saw the first one, and the way it was just composed in a way that it sustained, right? And then Greg felt so small behind her in a way that was very much more emotional than I ever thought it would be. And she was so strong in the foreground, so powerful, even though she was away from him, but so vulnerable, obviously, at the same time, but monumental in the way she kind of held and anchored the composition, that after, I think, the third or fourth take, whatever, the three of us were just bawling. And Chung and I just looked at each other, and I think, it's like, I think that's all we need. There is a little fear later, you know, and there were many times when we talked about morphing and taking out 6-7 seconds, because there's a very long beat of just silence. You know, is it going to, in context, out of context, that's the thing. Out of context, it could feel right. In context, it might just kill the movie or just stop it. And you don't want that either. But that just felt silly at some point, and a cheat, and it almost would, so you risk it all. And that just, again, your body kind of tells you. And I've also been always like, that's something I'm actually working on myself to get over. But because of TV, I never did a lot of coverage because I was afraid they would use just the coverage, because I had very little control in post. So I'd shoot a certain way. And so I try not to shoot a lot of coverages. I always have this thing of you're going to fall into that and it just becomes generic. But yes, it would be safe to do that and never use it, and but it's your secret. And I have to get past that and do it. And it's not a bad C word. Like, you could do it and feel, but that was just a point where I was like, this just feels right. And let's just move on. And you take a deep breath, you all hug, and then you move on to the next thing, knowing that you captured something really special. But it's just, it's all about intuition, I think.
Well, I just love the movie. I really do. If there are people who haven't seen it, you've got to find it and see it. And I wanted to ask you, the movie that Greg ultimately makes for her, was the idea always that it was going to be an experimental sort of film, or was there any other version of what that final sequence, other than the ones that are in the movie that failed, but one that would have succeeded that you thought about?
It kept evolving. In fact, we started production and that kept evolving, that idea. Because it wasn't, at some point, I remember my producer, Jeremy, said, well, we would just in the hospital scene, just use like shoot green screen or something like that and then put it in later. But that didn't feel right. You know, how do you do that with actors dying? You know, the whole moment, it just felt wrong. And the compilation of all their films also felt wrong because it was going to be almost like forced humor in some way. And we'd already, in that context, it just didn't feel right. Or is it? And then the approach to, as in the Brackage so many great experimental filmmakers became something we were playing with in the video store that he goes to, Warhol and all that, and Warhol being one of them. And he's from Pittsburgh, the big Pittsburgh Museum. It just started to evolve. So I sat down, I remember Ed Bursch and Nate Marsh, who made the film, would come over my apartment and we talk about it. And then I started to, well, let's do shapes. I knew I wanted to end in yellow. And I knew that the end had to be in yellow for a few seconds, just a solid color that symbolized her throughout. There were always color theory in that film, Hunters. I mean, I love doing that stuff. And that was always going to be dying to this during the film. And it was just going to be this color that hopefully by the time we finished the movie, that would have a meaning to it. Subconsciously, that it was something you'd associate with you, with her, and that being how she kind of transcends. And then we started experimenting. They'd show me tests, and then we started, okay, these are the fabrics that were, I'm trying to remember some of these because it's been a while now, but these are the fabrics that symbolize her. These are the colors that symbolize him, and things that were of things that they could do. But then at some point, for Greg, who was always hiding in with words, and he was so good with words, and kind of hides behind them, he was out of words. So it had to be non-linear. It had to be something beyond that only film can express through shapes and colors and that. And then they would go off and work on it and show me cuts, work on it, show me cuts, work on it, show me cuts, until we finished it. I think we made the final tweaks on set that day, I think, or the day before. It was like, okay, that's it. Like, it's either a little more this, a little more that, try this, until it worked. And then we projected it in the first rehearsal, and we were all a disaster, and they were a disaster. So much so that the Steadicam operator, we looked at each other. Did we shoot the rehearsal? Because had we shot the rehearsal, that would have been it. It was in sync. Everything was in sync that day. That film, that music, those performances. Very simple camera stuff. You know, really just very simple, and it does kind of go to the next level. Because of this beautiful union of emotion with filmmaking, not necessarily mine, I'm talking about, it's an experimental piece that was the best way to communicate loss and transcendence and ultimately kind of a maturity of him as a man and friend and maybe filmmaker, but it was her really passing on and dying to film, which is, you know, I'd like to be that person. I'd like to go that way too. But that was a way to express everything. And ultimately, what hit me so hard was that's what I was doing too. That's a realization to come at later. I was making a film for my dad. You know, I was doing this to understand this abstraction, which is grief and loss and circle of life, all that kind of stuff. You're able to put it into words much later, but it was very as personal as you can get is expressing your grief, your loss can't even talk, but you know what I'm saying? You know, with like color, you know? It's just so fresh. It's nuts, you know?
Yeah, just as a humble viewer, every time that scene comes up, it is equally as transcendent and devastating and it's beautiful. It's like a combination of all of it. It's like being in touch with the divine. And I feel like there are films out there where you have to sit through 2.5 hours of a Tarkovsky movie or something, and then you feel that, but you manage to condense it with the narrative of the story, with the experimental and the music and all of it. That it's just mind blowing, and I adore it.
And that's what I mean about the subconscious. That something is driving you, but something is you don't have words for, and it's only in as the filmmaking process of it coming together that it reveals so much of yourself and what you're trying to say. You don't need the words for sometimes, you know, you just have to trust. And there's something making you, forcing you to make this, tell the story. And eventually you know why. Sometimes you know why earlier, sometimes later, but it all kind of comes back and you realize that's why I was making this fully. Now I see it fully, you know, but there's a mystery to that again, it's intuition, it's your body. It's okay not to have words for it because you're making films, you know, that transcends words sometimes, you know?
Well, I cannot thank you enough for this incredible conversation and for all your time today. It really means a lot. And I know it will for our listeners as well. So
thanks, man. It was great. I really appreciated the conversation. Thank you.
And thank you everyone for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode. As usual, if you did and you have not yet, please do rate and subscribe and share about us. We're trying to grow. You can follow us at Movie Mentors Podcast on Instagram. We post a lot of fun behind-the-scenes photos from our guests and their projects. And we would love to hear from you. We would love to connect with you and get to know you. So follow us on there. You can also follow us on Facebook. But most importantly, y'all, stay safe, stay healthy, stay sane. Talk soon.